From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Today I'm joined by University of Oklahoma Latin America historian Alan McPherson for a conversation about what the lifting of trade and travel restrictions could mean for U.S.-Cuban relations.
They had prisoners, we had prisoners, and so prisoner exchange made a lot of sense. And I think that's one of the reasons that Alan Gross was made prisoner to begin with, so that the Cubans would have something to trade.
Then I'll talk with Boston University scholar David Collier. 65 years ago, Iran unsuccessfully experimented with democracy, and he argues the Islamic Republic can build on this legacy.
So I think Iran's system right now, it's not free as in the sense of the American system, but it does still maintain these institutions like the parliament, the office of president, which have a lot of history behind them and seen as quite important.
That's all coming up, but first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Alan McPherson, professor of international area studies and a Latin American historian. Welcome back to Worldviews.
Thank you.
So, Alan, we've got to talk about Cuba. Some very interesting developments in Cuba. As we all remember, last month, President Obama announced that there were coming changes in our relationship with Cuba, and there would be some lifting of some travel and trade restrictions. Not a lifting of the embargo, of course, because Congress has to do that. But the new rules are coming into effect this week, actually. So U.S. citizens can now use credit cards there. They have access to alcohol and tobacco. Everybody's excited about Cuban cigars. U.S. businesses have a little more leeway in being able to export some technologies like cell phones and internet access and those types of services. So some really interesting developments and changes. But Alan, you're an expert in this region. Give us some background here. Bring us up to speed on kind of how these things happened and what the implications are.
Well, first of all, it hasn't been happening that recently. I mean, the announcements by Obama came in December, but really this came after 18 months of talks between the U.S. government and the Raul Castro government. It's hard exactly to say what prompted this. I get a feeling that it's probably more the Cubans who prompted this. The United States has been open to doing this probably for the entire Obama administration. But Raul Castro has finds his country in real dire straits economically. It's not on the brink of catastrophe, but you know they've been opening up the economy to private enterprise, but they've also been firing a lot of people from government roles. And so they just need more imports, more exports, more hard currency from the United States. Plus, they had prisoners. We had prisoners. And so prisoner exchange made a lot of sense. And I think that's one of the reasons that Alan Gross was made prisoner to begin with, so that the Cubans would have something to trade.
Well, I mean, your point about how Cuba has been kind of in these dire economic straits. I mean, you know, if you look at the images coming out of Cuba over the years, I mean, it's like stepping back in time, right? I mean, you've got extremely old infrastructure, the buildings, the cars even. I mean, you just, you know, these are 1940s and 50s era cars that they're driving around in Cuba. So the need to modernize, the need to really kind of open up those opportunities. I mean, I think what's interesting about this, what do you think about the opportunity that this brings? Are we seeing that the future holds new opportunities and ways in which we can engage with the Cubans economically and otherwise?
Of course. I mean, the Cubans, in fact, for a communist economy, are very entrepreneurial people. They're very hardworking. They're always looking for opportunities. And in fact, if you've been Cuban for the past 20 years since the end of the Cold War, just surviving has meant trying to get every little – to squeeze every little dollar out of life that you can by knowing foreigners, by you know stealing from the government if you can, and so on and so forth. And so Cubans are really ready for private enterprise. They don't want full-scale capitalism, and that's not coming. I mean, we have to be really clear here that the embargo is not being lifted. There's no universal travel for Americans. And in fact, the response by Raul Castro to the announcement by Obama was that we have won. We have won the war. The revolution has survived. The embargo will probably be lifted, and we now need to build a sustainable communism. So that's the point. But it's communism with a certain measure of private enterprise at the very small scale. On that sense, nothing has changed. There's still no large enterprise in Cuba. And American businesses will still have to do business through the Cuban government, which is actually very cumbersome, and it's very slow, and it's very problematic. And so there's no floodgates that are going to open anytime soon.
Well, a U.S. delegation is traveling, a high-level delegation, relatively high-level delegation, the highest-level delegation that's traveled to Cuba since 1961 will be traveling to Cuba next week, I presume to kind of solidify some of these changes that are coming forward. But what about things like opening of embassies and consulates and just having regular interaction that's more formal and political in nature?
Well, that will happen. But at the same time, I think that there's a sort of a limited – it's mostly symbolic what's going on. I mean, the interest section that the United States has there is under the protection of the Swiss, but it's huge. And it still processes all of these visa claims, 20,000 visa claims a year. It's not going to do more really than it used to. It's going to do a little bit more, but mostly it'll change the sign from a Cuban interest section or American interest section to an American embassy, and it'll have an ambassador. And so I assume that there'll be more interaction with Cubans, and maybe the Secretary of State, maybe the President will eventually visit. But again, I don't think the Cubans want to move that quickly on any of that.
So finally, then. Not everyone's been happy about this. A lot of people are saying, yay, Cuban cigars, we get to go to Cuba, and this is great. I mean, long-term policy needs to change. But a lot of people aren't happy about this as well. And why would that be? Who are the holdouts here, and what are their concerns?
I think there are two groups. One is the sort of hardcore ideological Castro haters, mostly in Miami, in Florida. These are mostly now they're over 65 years old, and that's the only group that's still in a majority against lifting the embargo. Even the Cubans under 65 are for that. And the last group are Republican policymakers, both in Florida and nationally, who want to try to use this to win the state of Florida in 2016.
All right. Well, Alan McPherson, thank you so much for bringing your insight about this issue.
You're welcome.
If you have any comments about this conversation or any questions for Alan or me, let us know in the Worldview section of our website, kgou.org. We're also on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Guralot, and at AlanMcPherson1. Coming up, I'll talk with Boston University scholar David Collier about some of his work focusing on democracy in Iran. I'm Suzette Guralot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guralot. My guest this half hour is David Collier. He's a visiting scholar at Boston University's Center for International Relations, where he also earned his PhD in political science in 2013. His research examines the role the United States played both promoting and impeding Iranian democracy during the reign of the Shah from 1941 to 1979. David Collier, welcome to Worldviews.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, David, I want to start by looking at your work on U.S.-Iranian relations. But rather than talking first about contemporary relations and kind of where we are today, we should eventually get there. Mm-hmm. But let's go back. I mean, you really focus a lot on the historical relationship and some of the ways in which the United States has interacted with Iran for many decades ago. So kind of start, you know, historically and give us a sense of what that relationship has been like over time.
Right. Well, my interest in Iran came from looking at how the U.S. has sort of looked at democracy in the region. And I think in relation to Iran, we look at Iran today, you don't think too much about the democratization efforts that took part in the 20th century. So always when I was doing my research, I was quite surprised by how much democracy was a factor in U.S. relations with Iran and how democracy advanced in Iran. So I started my dissertation in looking at 1941 when the Shah was put on the throne. His father was basically told to leave. He was a bit too close to Nazi Germany. And so the Allied powers sort of told him, you have to leave and be replaced by your son, who we can maybe control better. And so for the first few years of Roosevelt's relations with the new Shah, the U.S. sort of promoted democracy and was happy to let democratic institutions grow. They made sure the Shah was placed more on the outside of politics, which is much to his annoyance. He wanted to be more involved, but he was still very young. I think he was 21, 22 when he first came to power. So he's more amenable to being pressured by the U.S. to stay on the outside. And over the course of the 20th century, the United States' interest in democracy kind of waned over time. Other interests such as oil and communism became more dominant, and democracy took a slightly back seat in how the U.S. approached Iran, especially with Iran being on the borders of the Soviet Union. So over time, after Roosevelt's passing in mid-40s, you see U.S. policy changing slightly and focusing more on stability, on security, and the Shah was seen as the best bet for maintaining security, and he was brought back into power. And over the course of the decades, more and more, he became more and more powerful. The U.S. supported him more and more, gave him more financial aid, more military aid. So over time, the U.S. interest in democracy waned, and anti-communism and stability was more important by the 70s, definitely. In the late 70s, they still supported him despite the big protests and the calls for democracy.
You said you were surprised by the history of democracy in Iran as you started to do your research. Can you give us some indication of what the signs of democracy were in Iran so that we have a better sense of its own democratic history and political culture that would have sustained a democratic form of governance at one point in time?
Yeah, well, Iran's democratic history dates back to like the 19th century. The late 19th century, there were many protests against the Qajar monarchy, demanding more rights, more freedoms. And there was a constitutional revolution in the early 1900s, which sort of set out more powers for the people, a parliament, trying to limit the powers of the monarchy. So the constitutional revolution continued for 5 or 6 years, but eventually was subsumed by the return to power of the Shah. So that was the first sort of main thrust of democracy in Iran. So they had a parliament since 1905, and their constitution was based, I think, on the Belgian constitution, which was the most advanced one at the time. So it was a very advanced, a lot of thought went into maintaining democracy and developing it in the best sense and the most modern way. So when the Shahs came back into power and there was the change in monarchy between the Qajars and the Pahlavis in 1921, the Shahs became more powerful, but these institutions still survived, although greatly undermined. So by the time the new Shah in 1941 came to power, he had to cope with these institutions. And it was these that the United States supported, the parliament, civil society, which had a little history of like 50 years of development. So these were around at that time.
I'm speaking with David Collier from Boston University's Center for International Relations. Let's take a short break, and then we'll shift gears and talk about the potential for democracy in Iran today. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, I'm talking with Boston University visiting scholar David Collier. When we left off, he traced Iran's democratic history back to the late 19th century, leading up to when the last Shah took the throne in 1941. So clearly Iran got caught up in Cold War politics like many other countries did around the world. You mentioned that democracy eventually took a back seat to interest in stability and security in the region vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. Therefore, the United States' support for democracy, you know, promotion of democracy in the region came to an end. But you've also written about how the United States played a significant role in impeding democracy and actually trying to prevent it from taking place. So it's one thing to say security and stability matters, and so we aren't promoting democracy, but it's another thing to say, you know, we're working against democratic revolution or democratic movements or democratization in this country. So what is it that might help us understand the move from a focus on state safety and security, which we can understand, mm-hmm. but the lack of or actually working against or actively working against democratization in Iran?
Mm-hmm. I think the main turning point was the coup, the 1953 coup, which came about after an uprising of of people power, people calling again for democracy and for more rights. And it took on a very nationalistic sentiment, I think, because the US and Britain had been trying to force Iran and undertake certain policies. This caused a sort of rising nationalism in Iran and a feeling that they wanted to regain control and power. And so the US came to see democracy as nationalism. And that was dangerous to their interests. They worried about Iran. If it was independent, it may move more towards the Soviet Union or to neutralism. And they were very keen on maintaining Iran as a source of an allied country in the region. And so democracy was sort of seen as being against U.S. strategic and security interests. So they actively sort of prevented it. So they didn't want another Mossadegh. They didn't want another return to nationalism and the chaos that ensues from there. And there's also the Tudor party in Iran, which was the Communist Party. They were very popular, and they worried if there was free elections, the Tudor would be able to come into power and Iran would be lost to communism that way. So democracy was seen as dangerous for the U.S. During the heights of the Cold War.
Well, so before we bring things up to date and talk about the potential for democracy today in Iran, let's first talk about something else you've done some work on, and that is the vision that Justice William O. Douglas had toward Iran. Mm-hmm. Douglas served on the Supreme Court of the United States from 1939 to 1975, and he lectured widely and wrote about Iran. It's something I think we don't really know much about. So tell us a little bit about how a Supreme Court justice actually played a role in this growing issue about democratization versus nationalism versus, you know, security and stability in this very important country.
Yeah, Douglas famously said that his role on the Supreme Court only took 4 days a week, which gave him lots of time for other interests. Some people say that's why some of his opinions weren't very thorough and sort of lacked sort of critical insights, but he did develop lots of different interests. He was very interested in the environment, in civil liberties, but he was also keenly interested in foreign affairs. And he was able to take many trips abroad to try and increase his knowledge of the world. He had some interests in the future, becoming Secretary of State or maybe President in the future. So he thought these trips would be helpful to give him a sense of importance of he's been to these places, he knows what he's talking about. And in the late 40s, early 50s, he took two trips to Iran. And he traveled throughout the country, met with the tribes, he met with the politicians, he met with Mossadegh. So he developed a very keen interest in Iran, and his own views were very strongly that democracy was the way forward, that the United States should support democracy, but not in the way that the U.S. shouldn't sort of not top-down democracy. He was interested in democracy coming from the bottom up, so supporting local grassroots initiatives to develop democracy, not in a Western image, but in an image that would form naturally from that country. So his views were very different to the United States government, and he was a senior figure at the time. So he had lots of influence. He wrote very popular articles and books. So his views on Iran were very important, I think. And he was very close to Roosevelt, which therefore made him important to Truman because he was seen as a potential presidential candidate in the future. So his views were very important at that time. But also in the early 60s with Kennedy, he had become a family friend of Joseph Kennedy, JFK's father. So he was very influential during the Kennedy period as well.
So it's interesting that he was somewhat of an advocate, given his background and interests, an advocate for promoting democracy and working closely with Iran. Is there a similar advocate like this today? Do we see anybody similar to Justice Douglas? It doesn't seem to me that it's very evident.
No, I don't think so. I think it's very hard today. He was almost unique in having a very high-level official of the United States being able to go to Iran and travel quite freely. I can't imagine that happening today at the moment with the relations between the two countries. But I think it's something that's definitely needed. I think one of his famous sayings was, Iran needs to be known more intimately by the West. And by that he means going there, meeting the people, meeting the tribes, not just the leaders, but the people in the cities and the villages. Which I think is something very important and something that we're missing today.
Well, so that leads us then to this issue of of Iran today? I mean, when we think of Iran today, certainly we don't necessarily think automatically of democracy and democratization. But it sounds like given their history and their background, there's that potential there. Given your studies and what you focus on today, your what you know about Iran today, how should we feel about this? Does this past experience give us any hope that perhaps there'll be a return to democratic governance someday in Iran? And is the United States, will the United States, can the United States help move that forward in any way, shape, or form? Obviously, you know, returning to some sort of normal relationship will be required for that, right? So, you know, is this likely to happen?
Yeah, I think democracy is very hard to define what democracy is. I think if you ask like 10 political scientists what democracy is, you'll get at least 11 or 12 different answers. So I think Iran's system right now, it does have elections, it does have a parliament. It's not free as in the sense of the American system, but it does still maintain these institutions like the parliament, the office of president, which have a lot of history behind them and seen as quite important. So these are still maintained today. And there's a lot of talk about having democratic legacies being important for future transitions to democracy. So all these things being maintained in the future, it's very likely that these things will help a future transition if the situation arises. But right now, I don't think the U.S. is interested in democracy right now in Iran. They're focusing on the nuclear issue first and foremost, and pretty much only that. And once that's settled, which will hopefully become settled, then they might start thinking about how can we sort of push more freedom or liberties in Iran. But for now, I think they're more focused on nuclear issues and seeing what will happen further down the road. But I think Iran is a good candidate for becoming a future democracy in more of a Western definition of democracy.
Civil society has been able to be maintained in Iran to an extent. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that there's some sort of kind of grassroots ability to move democracy forward if the opportunity arises.
Right, if the opportunity arises. They have experiences which they can build on in the future. Which is very important for democratization, but they need to be given the freedom to actually work on this in the open and sort of canvass people on the streets and things, which I think is not possible as much as it has been in the past in the early 20th century. I think it was a very different situation than today, but having these legacies of democracy is very important.
Well, David, thank you so much for being with us today on Worldviews to talk about this very important issue that has significant implications today for the United States and Iran both. So
thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with David Collier, who's a visiting scholar at Boston University's Center for International Relations. There's more information on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, Symphony Swift works as our research fellow, and our digital content intern is Sam Dupre. For Alan McPherson, I'm Suzette Gorlott.